Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, your host and CEO of Bregman Partners. This podcast is part of my mission to help you get massive traction on the things that matter most. Joel Peterson is here with us today. He's the chairman of JetBlue and a consulting professor at Stanford Graduate School of Business. He's written a book, The 10 Laws of Trust, Building the Bonds That Make a Business Great. It's a book that I really loved, and I'm excited to have you on the podcast today. Joel, welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
Thank you. Delighted to be with you, Peter.
Joel, the first question I have for you is, why write a book? You're chairman of JetBlue. You're probably a pretty busy guy. What drove you, what motivated you to write a book, and why this one?
You know, I've taught about 4,000 students over the last quarter century at Stanford Business School, and I wrote articles on LinkedIn, mostly just for my students, and they started to get picked up by others. Finally, somebody at AMA read several that I'd written on the power of trust, and they approached me and said, you know, this is really a pretty relevant topic in today's world. Would you mind writing a book? And I'd never thought of writing a book, but I do think trust is more powerful than power. So I was delighted to put some things down on paper.
You talk in the book about lacking the paranoia gene, and I thought that was very interesting. And I think that while there are some others that are probably with you, there are a lot who aren't. And so the idea that trust is a learnable competency, that if you haven't been born with the non-paranoia gene, if you were born with the paranoia gene, that in effect you can actually learn to trust. And I found that really interesting because I think that trust is one of the harder competencies, if you really even call it a competency, which you do, and I think you handle this really nicely in the book. It's one of the harder competencies to develop because it's so emotional. It's so elemental to who we are. Can you talk a little bit about the learnability of trust?
Yeah, and I think the way you described it as being emotional is the way a lot of people think about it, that it's this feeling we have. We sense that we can trust people. And while I don't think it's a mistake to trust our intuition, I actually think it's quite limiting and takes away some of the power of trust. Trust is a competency that you can develop. You can learn to have smart trust. There are rules. There are guidelines. You can build enterprises that are high trust businesses, but you have to kind of pay attention to the guardrails. If you go through the guardrails, you're going to destroy trust. It's built up slowly, a conversation at a time, an act at a time, and it can be destroyed very quickly. So I think you have to have a kind of rigor around trust. And I think most people think it's just a feeling that I've got, and it's not at all.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, you speak about this in the book, this idea of ancestral or generational or cultural mistrust, that in effect, many of us grow up with stories or advice from parents, from grandparents, from experiences that we've seen our ancestors go through that suggest that trust might be a little dangerous.
Yeah, well, if you don't trust, you'll never be betrayed. And we all know that. And so we can kind of inherit this wariness, but we won't get as much done. Most of the really great things that happen in life come through collaboration, through cooperation, through trusting other people. We trust all day long, really. We may not admit it, but we're empowered by trusting in a smart way. If we're not smart about it, the odds are we'll be betrayed and live to regret it.
You know, I think that's at the heart of it. When I think about the challenge of trust is the fear of betrayal. And I think if any of us, you know, live and work in an organization or just live in life, we're going to be betrayed. That's the nature of the true reality, that at some point in our lives we'll be betrayed in some way.
Yep.
How do we buffer our confidence in the context of probable betrayal at some point to continue to take that risk to trust?
Yeah. So I think that's a great question. And it's, I think, what keeps people from taking full advantage of the power of trust. I think there are a couple of things to remember. One is that you should grant trust slowly. You should trust people in small matters, and then you need to make them accountable. Sometimes people think, well, if you trust me, I don't need to be accountable. If you're making me report in, then you don't really trust me. In point of fact, accountability, reporting in, actually increases trust between people. It allows you to set up this contract, and I think you build on that. So you trust in small ways, they become broader ways, and then pretty soon you've measured somebody. It's that old thing that Reagan used to say about trust but verify.
I was about to bring that up. I was about to bring that up because I remember him saying that, actually, and I remember the press around it, and I also remember being a little suspect of it. Like, trust but verify sounds like don't trust.
Yeah. I remember Trammell Crowe used to say that we owed it to our accountants to do audits, that it wasn't fair to them not to do audits. And number one, it made it so that they could be proud of their work. They could do a great job. But number two, it kept them from any temptation of not fulfilling their obligations. And I think they go hand in hand.
I think, so let me push you on this a little bit. How is it trust? I mean, I agree with you, by the way, that we should verify and that we owe it to ourselves and our auditors and accountants. But how is it, I'm trying to reconcile these two things, that I trust and I'm going to inspect what you're doing to make sure that I can trust. And I think that's right, but I get stuck a little bit in the what seems like a contradiction.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do. But I think if you think about what we're doing together in this mutual trust covenant that we've got, is we're building trust together, and it's a process. And I'm going to you're going to give me your word on things. I'm going to check up on how things are going. I'm going to remove obstacles for you. We're going to talk about it. And you will build trust with me over time in that. And the same thing goes the other way. We're going to check in with each other. And trust builds when you do that.
And we shouldn't be bashful then of saying, look, I'm going to we're beginning this relationship. And I want to trust you, and I do trust you. And yet we need to build that trust. So I'm going to be inspecting and checking. And over time, as we build our trust bank account, in effect, and that, you know, we see that we could trust each other, then I'm going to have to do that a little less.
Yeah, for sure. Yep.
You know, because what's interesting is that a single betrayal, like I think about people who talk about, a pyramid scheme that Bernie Madoff, and suddenly every broker, every hedge fund manager, everyone's suspect because, you know, mostly what people said is nobody saw it coming. I mean, Elie Wiesel's foundation was with Bernie Madoff. And so when there's one betrayal of trust by one person in one place, it suddenly raises the level of mistrust across a nation in some ways.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's what you see with regulations now. There's so much with Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank, and these are the scar tissue of people violating trust. And so you end up with a bureaucracy, with a set of regulations that it may reduce the chances for that, but it also makes everybody a little bit more cautious and wary.
Joel, you talk about three conditions for trust, which I think is a good guideline in this conversation also, that says, you know, if you want to build trust, build it on the foundation of these three things: character, competence, and authority. Can you talk about each briefly? And also, I'm curious how we can assess each to know with confidence that we're making the right call.
Yeah. So character is just that thing that we learned at our mother's knee about somebody who has integrity, who does what they say they'll do. They've got your back. That's an important but insufficient element of trust. It's necessary that they have character, but somebody could have high character, your mother, for example, and not be able to deliver on what you're requiring. For example, fly a 747 to London. You shouldn't trust her to do that unless she's a qualified pilot.
So she's someone you might trust, but you wouldn't trust her to do everything.
Exactly. You trust her to have your back. You'd trust her never to do anything that violated your best interest, but you wouldn't trust her to achieve certain things. And we trust a lot of people to deliver results. So the person we trust also has to have competence. And so that's measured in lots of ways. We reference check, we watch them, they may have licenses or whatever, but we pay attention to competence. But even those two aren't enough. For example, if I asked you, let's say you're a competent tax attorney, and I tell you that I'm trusting you for that I won't have to pay taxes next year. Well, you don't have the authority to change the tax law. You have high character, you're competent, but you don't have authority. You're not empowered to deliver on that promise or on that hope of mine. So I shouldn't trust where you don't have the authority to deliver. So I look at it as all three of those conditions are preconditions for granting full trust to somebody.
What's interesting too is that if, you know, we might be the cause of the lack of one of those. So for example, you may have character and you may have competence, but if I don't trust you, I may not give you the authority, in which case it's a cycle and you will end up not being trustworthy because you won't have the authority to get stuff done. But it's my mistrust that's preventing you from having that authority. Have you seen those cases?
Yeah, I think that happens a lot of times in organizations where people are given assignments, they have competence to achieve those assignments, but they get the rug pulled out from under them. They're not really given the authority to deliver. They're not given really, they're not really measured sometimes. If you disconnect authority, measures, competence, you get people behaving in strange ways. Things become quite political when you divide these things up.
Yeah, it occurs to me also, I mean, I think these three conditions are really very formative, that I've seen people who have character, I think, who have authority, I know, but who have competence to do some of what they are mandated to do, not all of it. And when they fail in one piece of it, then it's very easy to write them off for all pieces of it. That in effect, you know, that we have to be really clear about the boundaries of each of these. There's, in some ways, character is maybe boundaryless, but competence and authority certainly have boundaries.
For sure. Yeah, nobody has boundless competence or authority. And so you can violate trust, you know, if people are expecting you to deliver. Fundamentally, trust is delivering on promises. Your own personal brand is your promise. You know, what do people expect in dealing with you? That's your brand, and people learn to trust that brand. And if you're unable to deliver on that promise, then it damages trust and your brand.
You know, there's a great salesperson who once told me, he asked me this question, you know, how do you build trust? And this was probably 20 years ago. And I said, you know, like you build a relationship, you meet them, you think of them, and then you send them, an article that made you think of them, and you begin to build trust that way. And he said, you're missing a step. He said, the first thing you should do before you send them that article is you call them or you send them a note and tell them you're going to send an article, and then you send the article. And what you're doing is building a track record of trust by creating expectations that you can then fulfill. That in effect, if you're just sending the article, that's nice and that's connecting, but it's not creating trust. Creating trust is telling him you're going to send him an article and then sending him the article.
That's a great point. Yeah.
And you know, I know people who do the opposite, right? Who overpromise from really great places in their heart. They want to fulfill the promise, but they're overpromising. And so I had this happen to me recently. Someone sent me an email saying, I got your email, I'm going to get back to you tomorrow. And they didn't get back to me tomorrow. So they created an opportunity to break trust. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, it kind of works both ways.
Yep. So whenever I think about running a company or coaching a leader, I always think that you break down where it is you're trying to go into projects. So it's a series of projects that get you to the summit that you're trying to achieve. And that those projects have champions, they have budgets, they have deliverables, and they have timeframes. And I think if you manage those in a high trust manner, then these champions deliver on time, on budget, and they deliver what they said they're going to deliver. And that builds trust. And if you do that over and over in an organization, not only do you achieve a lot of summits, but you build a lot of trust between team members who are belayed on the cliffs together as they're summiting.
Joel, when you say if you manage these in a high trust manner, what's a high trust manner to manage those in?
Well, it starts, I think, with the leader having integrity. What that means is the leader delivers on his or her promises, but it quickly becomes a matter of respect. And respect is shown in a lot of different ways, but people have a sense of whether or not they're respected, and that usually means they're listened to. So we sense that we're respected when somebody really captures what it is we're saying. Then I think it moves quickly to communication, and I believe communication is the best way to develop trust. People who build high-trust organizations tend to communicate before, during, and after events, and they communicate bad news as well as good news. And anytime that people spin, you know, we're so used to various people in authority spinning the news to us that we've become mistrustful as a society. In contrast, if you just say, look, I'm going to tell you how it is all the time. I'm not hiding things. I'm not spinning things. You actually build, people may not like it all the time, but you build trust.
You talk, Joel, about love in the book, and I really loved the idea of the love motivator as trust, of trust. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so I basically lay out that there are five primary motivators that you can cram pretty much everything we do into one of these. We can either be forced to do something at the point of a gun or a bayonet. We can do something out of fear. These are extraordinarily powerful motivators in the short run. You can do things out of a hope for a reward, which is a very common one. We do things and we hope we'll be paid in some way for it. We can do it out of a sense of duty. It's a sense of obligation we have to others, to our ancestors, to tradition, to whatever matters and is sacred in life. Or we can do it out of love, where there's a real mutual interest. And, you know, we would sacrifice anything for probably family members, our children. The closer you can get to this kind of reciprocal trust that exists between partners and family members, the higher the bonds of trust that allow you to achieve and to innovate and collaborate and move quickly and be flexible. So it's really the most powerful of all the motivators, and it's the most enduring. It's probably the most fragile. It can be betrayed, but it's more powerful than the gun.
You know,
the gun will only work as long as the gun's present. You lay the gun down and people do something else, whereas love just endures.
I was thinking about this because I think one of the reasons why it can be so easily betrayed is because in love, we tend not to verify in the same way, that there's a sort of understanding and a commitment. And if it's not held with love, if it's not held with respect and clarity and competence, then I think it's very easy to feel betrayed.
Yeah. And it probably wasn't a real trust. It wasn't a deep trust in the beginning, if it can be that easily betrayed. And that's one of the reasons that I said, you know, there's 10 laws. And I think if people will follow these laws and see them as guardrails and not breach them, you know, that they can build and maintain high trust. But it takes a certain level of discipline, you know, to do it. Trust just doesn't happen. You know, it requires a kind of an intentionality.
And these are the laws that ultimately, if followed, will bring us to that level of love, trust.
That's what I think. I think within an organization, an insightful leader who's committed to building high trust can actually bring an organization to dealing on the basis of love and trust. It happens rarely. It happens in degrees. Some very high trust organizations are able to operate that way for long periods of time. It's a lot of work, and it requires a lot of the leader.
So this is my question to you, and I'm asking it to you, Joel, as a practitioner not just as an academic and a writer, but as someone who lives and breathes this in your organizations. Most of these rules are not controversial, right? Invest in respect, empower others, measure what you want to achieve, embrace respectful conflict. Most of us would read this list and say, this is right. These are right. What makes them so hard to follow through on?
We're human. We're short-sighted. We solve for what's right in front of us. We're busy. You know, it takes time. You want to create a common dream. Well, it's not you just you sitting down at your typewriter and typing something up that sounds good. It really means the ugly work of sitting down with lots of people over a period of time and hashing it out and listening without an agenda. You know, we become impatient. You know, it's hard to be humble. I mean, one of them is to show vulnerability, to show humility. You know, you tend to trust people who are vulnerable, who are humble, who you know listen well. You trust them if all other things are pleasant. Well, who likes being humble? You know, it takes some discipline. So I think a lot of these things really require something of us that is not natural, which is why I say it's intentional. It's something you have to decide that your brand is worth building a conversation at a time, an action at a time, a project at a time, a deliverable at a time, and you're going to hold yourself to that standard, and you're going to hold others to that standard if you want to build a high-trust organization. Most of us get lazy. We do shortcuts. We get frustrated. We move on by it, and we blow the doors off of trust, and they're hard to rebuild once you've betrayed.
Finally, I think that's really right, and I'm curious, to me, as I read this book, I want to say that it's more than just, you know, a theoretical and practical write-up of what you've seen work in organizations. There's something personal to this too, and I'm curious, Joel, as to, you know, what, like, when I say what led you to write the book, certainly you were teaching these things and AMA said, hey, why don't you make a book about it? But I don't think one writes a book like this unless there's some deeper connection in effect. And this is, you know, the trust itself is something that comes from a deep connection. And I'm wondering kind of what your experience has been around trust and whether you know, there are challenges that you've had to overcome that have helped you to get to this place where you kind of understand trust at a deeper level.
Yeah, so I've had the experience of betrayal and the experience of building super high trust relationships. Within the family, I have incredible relationships with my kids, and I've built these over the year, and they've mattered a lot, and so I've worked really hard at it. I remember in college, I had a professor one time who talked a lot about how to build a great marriage. And I remember asking him one time, how did you come to so many insights about building that kind of a relationship? And he said, because I've had a really tough marriage. I've had to really work at it. And that seemed counterintuitive when he first said it. But now I really realize I've had to deal with a couple of betrayals that have been painful. And I've had to think through, well, why did I make the mistake of trusting somebody who shouldn't have been trusted? How do I overcome that betrayal? Do I trust again? So it's been kind of a personal struggle that has given me insight, which is, I think, how we learn most of the really important lessons in life.
That marriage story is so interesting because it speaks to the fact that the, you know, what we're afraid of is betrayal, but the truth is that in some ways, to build a capacity to trust, you're almost saying requires betrayal on a certain level, that then you can understand the value of that trust. And we would all like to not have to learn it this way, but that the only way to really ground yourself in this kind of trust is actually by risking it and by being betrayed and by committing to it and working at the rules, right? The your 10 laws and the down and dirty work of taking the time to listen, to empathize, to feel, to be in relationship in a way that then builds longer lasting, deeper trust.
I think that's well said and unfortunately quite true. I do think we can get better at catching small betrayals, because most small betrayals are misunderstandings. People have not been clear about things, and so they feel betrayed, and then they create defensive behaviors, or they hide things or whatever. So I've learned over time to be completely transparent. As soon as I find something that I'm worried may be a betrayal, I confront people. I ask them about it. We talk about it. We sort it out. So I don't let it get to the point that it becomes a full-fledged betrayal, which is very difficult to correct and fix, and in many cases, not worth it.
I'm sort of curious about this. I maybe had said final question before, but I'm going to say it again because it's just coming to me as I'm listening to you, Joel. You know, what about like trusting in the world, in effect, meaning that, you know, you hear people say the universe is a friendly place, or Einstein, I think, said, you know, you have to make this decision as to whether you're going to choose to believe that you live in a world that you can trust or that you can't trust. I butchered it. He said it with different words. But I wonder, you know, you can't really verify, you know, like if we're talking about trust in God or trust in, you know, the mandate of your organization or just trust in the universe, you can't, I may be out here a little bit for some of our listeners. This is a podcast on leadership, but I think it's, you know, it's an interesting question, which is that when you can't do that kind of verifying, when you can't know for sure the you know, if the world is trustworthy, and yet it feels so important to so many people to live in a world that they trust. Do you have any advice around that?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you understand the laws of human nature and the laws of economics and, you know, kind of how the world works, there's a certain predictability. I think it was Norman Cousins that said, wisdom is the ability to predict the future. And it's kind of the ability to sort of see around corners, to see beyond horizons, because you know how things fit together. You can then trust in that world. It may not be a friendly place. It may be a harsh place. These may be harsh laws and harsh realities, but you can learn to trust them because you understand them. I think if it is this sort of ultimate question about the nature of man, good or evil, I think people have both capacities. And I think the more that you develop trusting relationships, the more trustworthy people become, the happier they become, the more productive they become. I think you create virtuous cycles in this. I think those same people can become wary and can be mistreated and learn to be mistrustful. And I think things grind to a halt when that happens. So I think the universe provides us with both, and it's up to us to determine what we want our brand to be.
We're here with Joel Peterson. His book is The 10 Laws of Trust, Building the Bonds That Make a Business Great. I really enjoyed the book, and I've really enjoyed this conversation. Joel, thank you so much for being on the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
My pleasure, Peter. Great questions, and thank you for the discussion.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode, and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next great conversation.